This is the Porno Cultures Podcast, the show where we think about pornography rather than just react to it. This is the Porno Cultures Podcast. I start off each interview of this podcast with the same question. What was your first experience with pornography like? How old were you? And what lasting impression did your first experience leave with you that you still carry with you to this day? Not only do I like to ask this question as a type of icebreaker to relax the overly serious nature of the formal interview, but I also like to ask it because it helps to bring the guest back to a time when pornography was something new, fresh, and exciting, before pornography became a job or an academic pursuit. As with any academic endeavor, once you delve too deeply into a topic, it can sometimes lose its ability to elicit surprise and wonder within one's sensibility. And except for the grad student roundtable episode, the rest of our guests are of a certain age where they've recalled their first encounter with pornography being with print magazines rather than with digital images. Even my own first encounter with pornography was print rather than digital. With the recent collapse of magazine culture due to the internet, scholars are just now starting to reevaluate the important role that magazines played within sexual cultures. F. Hollis Griffin's book, Feeling Normal, Sexuality and Media Criticism in the Digital Age, has a chapter dealing with the impact that free magazines given out in gay bars had in creating a unique gay ecosystem within urban centers. And in her episode with Susanna Pasanen, she goes into great detail about the strong pornographic print culture in Finland that overshadowed a film and video pornographic revolution that was happening throughout Western Europe and America. And in our episode with Whitney Strube, we talk about a couple of different magazines analyzed in his anthology, Porno Chic and the Sex Wars. The first covering the magazine Viva, the Bob Guccione-run magazine intended for a female audience, and the second being FI News, FI being short for Female Impersonators, a magazine in the 1970s and 80s dedicated to transgender and drag political issues and sexual desire. Needless to say that magazines are an essential part of pornographic history and culture. Today's episode is all about pornographic magazines, particularly the queer pornographic magazines On Our Backs, aimed at lesbians, and Physique Pictorial, In Touch, In Heat, Skin Flicks, Skin, Blue Boy, and Mandate, aimed at gay men. This episode is broken up into two separate presentations analyzing the sexual dynamics of each of these magazines. The first half of the episode explores the work of Elisabeth Groeneveld, who has done work on Our Backs magazine. Elisabeth is the author of Making Feminist Media, Third Wave Magazines on the Cusp of the Digital Age, published by Wilfrid Laurier University in 2016. We start off with a short one-on-one before she presents her paper at the Society for Cinema and Media Studies Conference. We cover the importance of On Our Backs as a political voice within the lesbian community, and her talk covers a very crucial point in the magazine's history where they must decide whether to amplify their pornographic content in order to increase revenue, which some on the editorial board were against because they were afraid it might alienate their core fan base. Interestingly, Elisabeth finds letters to the editor regarding readers' thoughts about the erotic content of the magazine, and I think you'll be very surprised at the reaction that the readers have to the pornographic content. And the second half of the episode features my discussion with Danielle Loren, who is a PhD student in the Cinema and Media Studies Department at the University of Toronto. He wrote a paper analyzing his research on a group of gay male magazines from the 1970s, 80s, and 90s to analyze the figure of the gay-for-pay pornography performer. The traditional narrative of the gay-for-pay porn performer is that they emerge in the wake of the AIDS crisis in the mid-1980s to provide an example of a strong, healthy, and dominant male figure standing in opposition to the sick, weak, and AIDS-infected gay male image that was dominating media depictions at the time. However, Daniel's research into these magazines tells a very different story. His archival research proves that, in fact, the marketing and fascination with the gay-for-pay performer started in the pages of these magazines long before the AIDS crisis. Both of these scholars have produced remarkable scholarship around these magazines, and I'm really excited to share it with you on this episode. So first, here is my interview with Elisabeth Groeneveld, followed by her talk, doing queer feminism and making lesbian pornography, the publishing practice of On Our Backs magazine. Hi, so we're in the lobby here in the Sheridan Center in Toronto, and I'm here with Elizabeth Groeneveld. She's going to introduce herself, some of the work that she does, and then we'll get to talk a little bit about the paper that she's going to be presenting here at SCMS in Toronto. So Elizabeth, tell our audience a little bit about yourself.
Thanks. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Women's Studies at Old Dominion University, which is in Norfolk, Virginia. I teach in the area of feminist media studies, and the work that I do primarily examines zines and magazines. My previous work has been on a set of third wave feminist media productions that started as zines in the 1990s and then gradually developed into more larger circulating magazines. And I sort of track the historical trajectories of those publications and what they tell us about feminism on the cusp of the digital age. In the process of doing that research, I became really interested in how these magazines were covering issues to do with sex, sexuality, sexually explicit material like pornography. And I found that there was some really interesting historical resonances between how sexually explicit materials or images or advertisements for sex toys or vibrators resonated with earlier debates within feminism about the politics of pornography. And these sets of debates were particularly active in the 1980s, and they're usually called the sex wars. Some people don't like that term because it is very combative, kind of militaristic language, and they think that it kind of calcifies two discrete camps without necessarily acknowledging the nuances of the different perspectives. However, these debates were really divisive and often quite personal between people. And so I've had a long-standing interest in the sex war debates, and I thought that looking at a magazine like On Our Backs, which was publishing during the 1980s, would potentially give me some insights into how people were writing about and thinking about these debates. So I think in the fall of 2016, a friend of mine told me that the entire archive of On Our Backs back issues had been published online through a website called Reveal Digital. Reveal Digital works with libraries across the United States to digitize their archival collections. And they have an LGBT collection, and On Our Backs was part of that. So I started looking through these back issues, and I was particularly interested in the letters to the editor for this magazine. And I found that readers were writing in and talking about what On Our Backs meant to them, how it helped them understand their identities as lesbians, and were often referencing these debates about pornography within feminist thought.
Now, just a quick question for those who don't know, On Our Backs, it's a feminist magazine, but was it sexually oriented? Is it like lesbian pornography? Is it political? What is On Our Backs?
Yeah. On Our Backs, its subtitle was Entertainment for the Adventurous Lesbian. So it was a lesbian sex magazine that contained pornography. It was pornography made by and for lesbians. And the magazine took its name as a kind of send-up of a feminist magazine called Off Our Backs. Off Our Backs had published a lot of material pertaining to the sex wars debates, but it was perceived as largely being on the pro-censorship side. And so On Our Backs, the title itself is this kind of playful send up and also a way of distinguishing itself from the perspectives on pornography that were put forth in Off Our Backs. The magazine has a kind of sex-positive feminist approach. The editor and publishers, Nan Kinney, Debbie Sundahl, and Susie Bright, identify as feminist within the pages of the publication. But it didn't specifically say, like, on the masthead or on the cover, you know, this is a feminist magazine. They primarily describe themselves as a lesbian porn mag. And yet, there are lots of ways that the kinds of discussions that were happening within On Our Backs during the 1980s and into the early 90s were in conversation with what was going on within feminist thought. And so my research sort of took me into looking at these letters to the editor as a way of thinking about kind of the more everyday ways that readers were interacting with and thinking about the sex war debates. Then I returned to the archive towards the end of August of 2016 and found that the entire On Our Backs collection was no longer available. And so I then emailed Reveal Digital and discovered that they had removed the collection, at least temporarily, for two reasons. One, there had been concerns about copyright. And while legally Reveal Digital was in the right when it came to copyright, they'd secured permission from the publisher. Some librarians, namely Tara Robertson, who's an activist librarian in the Vancouver area, I believe, had written a series of articles and also written to Reveal Digital, raising concerns about, you know, what it means for women who maybe contributed to the magazine in the 1980s before the internet was really a thing. And then suddenly their pictures are online. And so to me, this raises some really interesting conundrums around the politics and ethics of digitization, and also what we do when our historical documents are also pornographic ones. Another concern that came up around this collection was that Reveal Digital had not put any filters on it to restrict the content based on age. So technically, they were in violation of pornography laws in some US states. And so for me, I find it really fascinating that this magazine continues to be controversial, even though it stopped publishing in 2006, 12 years later, it's still causing these kinds of ripple effects. So the paper that I'm giving today kind of draws on some of the research that I've done, both in terms of these letters to the editor and in terms of the digitization of these materials. And it's trying to think about what the story of this magazine then tells us about the relationship between making media and doing feminism. So today I'll be talking a little bit about some of the behind-the-scenes archival research that I did at Brown University on their archives, where I had access to meeting minutes. And there's a very interesting point in the early 1990s where staff of On Our Backs were debating sort of remaking the magazine into kind of a lesbian playboy. So kind of moderating some of their more hardcore content. And one of the reasons that they were looking to do this was to make the magazine more financially sustainable. My research in the archives from this time suggests that the magazine was in a fair amount of debt. And so the paper that I'm giving today is looking at the story of On Our Backs, thinking about this particular moment in the early 1990s, and then trying to make a larger claim about this moment, not as a moment of, you know, selling out or co-optation, but as a kind of adaptation, as a way of not censoring its more hardcore content, but kind of trying to broaden the scope of the magazine so that it could remain sustainable. And I think that tells us things about the struggles more generally of feminist and queer media production within the more conventional commercial marketing frameworks.
I don't know how tapped in you are to what's going on today, but where do you see the legacy of On Our Backs today? Like, are there magazines, websites that you see and you say, wow, they have a lot of the same traits that On Our Back had?
That's a great question. I don't know if that's a question I can answer right now.
Back then, you needed to have one central resource. Now the internet is the platform, but the platform is so big that it's hard to...
Yeah, my guess is that most queer, lesbian, bi pornography that's being made today owes an enormous debt to On Our Backs because they really paved the way. And I think there's a way that that magazine has a kind of pedagogical function sometimes. Like, really, they're writing about different aspects of sex positivity. They're talking to readers about how to enjoy pornography. And so I really think that they created a space for those media productions to be made.
Well, thanks so much. We're looking forward to hearing the paper. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. The title of my paper is Doing Queer Feminism and Making Lesbian Pornography, the Publishing Praxis of On Our Backs magazine. This paper acknowledges the existence of sex. On Our Backs magazine was a lesbian sex magazine published out of San Francisco from 1984 to 2006. Subtitled Entertainment for the Adventurous Lesbian, this paper argues that On Our Backs played a vital role in helping to cultivate sex-positive feminist lesbian public cultures. Yet, research that I conducted last year at Brown University's On Our Backs archive suggests a more complicated story about the magazine's relationship to sex positivity. Editorial minutes and critique notes show that On Our Backs staff was concerned about the potential loss of revenue resulting from their depictions of BDSM, bondage, domination, sadism and masochism, and more quote-unquote hardcore content, so imagery depicting penetration. I use this tension between the sex-positive philosophy of the magazine and the imperative to sell it to ask a set of larger questions about the relationship between making media and doing feminism, and of the limit points of media productions that engage the traditional publishing roots of the capitalist marketplace. Sex positivity is a set of discourses that work toward destigmatizing sexual practices such as BDSM, sex work, and pornography. Sex positivity promotes the importance of consent and values pleasure as a significant part of sexuality. The consolidation of these discourses under the banner of sex positivity emerged during the 1980s when feminists and others debated the politics of sexual practices, particularly SM and pornography. Some feminists believed that these practices were patriarchal and oppressed women, while others adopted an anti-censorship position, arguing that feminists ought not to stigmatize different forms of consensual sexual expression. The anti-censorship position became known as the sex-positive feminist approach to sexuality. On Our Backs signaled its position in the sex wars through its title, which was a send-up of a well-known radical feminist magazine called Off Our Backs. Off Our Backs provided coverage of the sex wars debates, however many felt that this coverage was biased in favor of the anti-pornography side. The title On Our Backs celebrated the pleasure in receiving sexual satisfaction and implicitly represented Off Our Backs as anti-sex. So I have just a few quotations from readers in letters to the editor. One writes, "Your magazine has supported my feelings and recent discoveries that sex is okay. Thanks for bringing lesbian lust out of the closet. And it helps me know that I'm not the only lesbian who desires vanilla sex. And finally, thought I was the only dyke in the whole damn world who loves erotica. Guess this means I'm out of the closet again, doesn't it?" And these are just a few reader letters to the editor where they're commenting on how the magazine opens up a kind of possibility of enjoying sex and enjoying pornography as a valued part of their identity as lesbians. So On Our Backs provided a voice for sex-positive lesbian feminism by fostering pedagogies of pleasure among its readership. The first issue of the magazine contained a full-page, pin-up-style centerfold picture of Honey Lee Cottrell, captioned Bulldagger of the Season. In their next issue, the magazine published a letter from a reader identified only as Kay, who wrote in to ask, "Was the Bulldagger of the Season a real centerfold for perusal, excitement, or a satire on heterosexual centerfolds? Please excuse my naivete because I really don't understand." This is a shot of that letter to the editor, which is quite earnest and very sweet. In her response to this letter, editor Susie Bright encourages the reader to enjoy viewing the image in ways that work to destigmatize sexually explicit media. "Bulldagger of the Season was meant to tickle your funny bone," she assures the reader, "as well as your clit." The editorial response to this letter is an articulation of sex-positive feminism, an affirmation that it is okay for the reader to find pornographic images pleasurable and exciting to look at. So really, Susie Bright here is kind of teaching the reader, like, this is how you look at lesbian pornography. and it's okay to masturbate to it. In examining readers' letters to On Our Backs in the 1980s, the presence of the sex wars is quite striking. At least one letter references these debates, either explicitly or implicitly, in every issue during the magazine's first 5 years. And so here's just a couple of examples. Bridget writes, "I think the women who criticize On Our Backs are just afraid of the revealing nature of SM. They trash it out of fear of their own possibilities instead of politics. And second, it's no wonder feminists would want to ban the magazine. They would rather condone censorship than admit that lesbians are into things like penis substitutes, aka dildos." Many of these letters are personal, connecting political debates to the politics of SM and definitions of what constitutes a lesbian to individual experiences. The letters reveal a sense of what it could feel like to be a lesbian in the 1980s, indicating that one paradigm of lesbianism at that time was as a feminist political identity. These letters demonstrate how On Our Backs served a kind of pedagogical role in helping promote sexual pleasure as a valued part of lesbian identity. So while sex positivity was the dominant framework that shaped On Our Backs' editorial approach, behind the scenes there were debates among staff about the economic viability of including images depicting acts of BDSM, given that some readers found this content a turnoff. By the early 1990s, publisher Debbie Sundahl was advocating the idea of remaking On Our Backs into a kind of lesbian Playboy magazine. Retreat notes from 1993 chart this move. Initial notes toward a new mission statement include a list of words generated by the staff, as well as some draft sentences. So the list of words begins with lesbian, sex, intelligent, resource/education, quality, and responsible. The words nasty, down and dirty, and aggressive sex also appear here on this list alongside classy and sophisticated, which is actually listed twice. Lisa Henderson's notion of queer relay shapes my interpretation of this archival document. Henderson opens her essay on queer relay by describing a form of queer anxiety about a queerness defiled by markets and commerce. As an alternative to discourses of impurity, loss, selling out, or co-optation, Henderson proposes the idea of relay, a term that highlights more reciprocal forms of influence, even under the unequal power relations of the media marketplace. For Henderson, relay refers to, in her words, an ongoing, uneven process of cultural passing off, catching, and passing on. Using the idea of queer relay, then, we can think about On Our Backs' efforts to remake itself as a quote-unquote lesbian playboy, and this was the phrase that they used, as a strategic effort to have both a magazine that honors a diverse range of lesbian sexualities and a magazine that's commercially viable. In Henderson's essay on queer relay, she includes a chart that illustrates the space of queer relay as working between industry orientations and queer orientations. Industry orientations include universalism, economic wealth, and mainstream recognition, while in contrast, queer orientations include queer worldmaking, economic enablement, and community cultivation. I read On Our Backs' efforts to remake the magazine as a kind of lesbian playboy as an attempt to move between and straddle these orientations in terms of representing both vanilla, quote-unquote, and kinky or more adventurous sex, to produce a high-quality magazine in terms of its production values, to reach a wider lesbian community beyond those who read On Our Backs for the pornography, and to balance its more controversial content. Meeting minutes from 1992 suggest that the reorientation of On Our Backs towards lesbian playboy status was indeed shaped by a need to make the magazine more marketable. The minutes note, "It seems we're reshaping our goal. This will help keep us ahead of the competition." And many agree with Nan, or Nan Kinney, who was the associate publisher, that ads like Galena, which was a body piercing company, and Spanking, are what people that look at the mag freak out on the most. We all agree that we can be major sexy and even controversial without hardcore imagery. These changes will enhance the Meg for our current readers and will give non-readers more reasons to read. Plus the Playboy excuse, I buy it for the articles. Certainly, the reorientation of On Our Backs seems to be about expanding the reading audience, not necessarily getting rid of all the hardcore imagery, but supplementing that imagery with other representations that expand the reach of the magazine. So what does this story of On Our Backs tell us about the relationship between making media and doing queer feminism? To return to Henderson, a relay view is neither a vision of queer politics untainted by capitalism, nor a position that advocates for leaving things as they are. Queer Relay allows for and critiques the economic oppressive system of capitalism while also acknowledging that it's the system under which we're currently operating. Under Our Backs' project of reworking the magazine as a lesbian playboy was in the effort of making it more viable in the commercial marketplace. Additional documents from this period suggest that the magazine was having difficulties. Notes from another early 1990s meeting contain the subheading, Ideas on Getting Cash Now, and a comment from associate publisher Kinney, We're not going to make it with this debt. Distributing a magazine or a film or a video through traditional publishing routes requires engagement with a sphere that is usually inhospitable to media production by feminist and queer folks and people of color. Yet this sphere is important, and it's valuable for people to see themselves represented in mainstream media publishing and for queer feminist media producers to continue to infiltrate the media industries. The second thing we can take from this analysis is that, to quote Liza Johnson, feeling costs money. What this means is that it costs money to create media with certain production values, where people can, for example, watch pornography, respond effectively, and not get distracted by the terrible resolution of the images. It's about having the resources to control how you want the media product to look. In this sense, queer feminist media praxis usually involves getting into bed with money. So what can the struggles of a magazine from the 1980s tell us about the relationship between making media and doing feminism today in a media environment that arguably bears little resemblance to the 1980s? Social media has fundamentally reshaped how feminist and queer folks do media activism. While online media spaces are often framed as utopian spaces with no restrictions on content, in practice, this isn't the case. Recent efforts to digitize On Our Backs as part of an archive on LGBT materials raised concerns about violation of pornography laws in some US states, and the magazine was removed from the internet. And this was a much more complicated case as well, that also involved folks raising concerns about getting permission from folks who had contributed to the magazine back in the 80s or 90s, prior to the internet really being a thing. So it's something I talk about in a larger article. The end of net neutrality in the United States also potentially signals more limits on the kinds of access people have to lesbian-made lesbian pornography that is sex-positive and ethically made. In this sense, there remains a clear need for media production that is easily findable, feminist, and fun to look at. The tiny piece of the On Our Backs story that I've shared today shows us the publication's adaptability, which is not the same thing as selling out or co-optation. Media production, even feminist queer production, is imbricated in the systems that also oppress queer people, particularly queer people of color and poor folks. But that doesn't mean that queer feminists can abdicate from this important terrain. A queer feminist approach to media making needs to acknowledge this, not ignore it, and to amplify the voices of QPOC, cis and trans women, and non-binary folks in ways that On Our Backs arguably fell short of doing. Nonetheless, On Our Backs carved out a space for sex-positive lesbian sexual representation from 1984 to 2006, and this matters. Thank you.
Next segment is my talk with Daniel Loren about his paper, He May Scorch the Screen with Men, But He Shares His Bed with a Woman, discussing sexual identity in pre-AIDS gay porn magazines. So I'm here with Daniel Loren, who's a graduate student at the University of Toronto. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Could you tell us maybe a little bit about your project? What are you working on as far as your wider dissertation research?
Sure. My dissertation research looks at straight performers in gay pornography. The moment I look at specifically starts around the middle of the 2000s. So looking at websites and studios like Amateur Straight Guys, Broke Straight Boys, and I track what I see as a movement from amateur aesthetics to reality aesthetics, and then the discourses around each of those movements and each of those styles, the kind of masculinities that amateurism are interested in and the type of masculinities that reality are interested in, and then the kind of viewing practices that go along with each of those styles.
Yeah, and me and Tom Waugh putting together an edited collection, and you're in it, and I have to say, your chapters are the one I'm most jealous of, because I wish I could have written it myself, where you compare the reality aesthetics of the gay porn studio Cocky Boys with the reality television aesthetics. That's kind of like the essential kind of arc of the whole dissertation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the main features of my dissertation is looking at pornography's desire for new authenticities, so the kind of traditional authenticity claims of pornography being money shots, erections, close-ups of penetration, so meat shots. But those have existed for so long now that I think that people are looking for something more and looking for additional authentifying elements. And so what I see in this video produced by Cocky Boys called Fuck Yeah Levi Carter is I see the kind of extreme end of that. So the video is pornographic in that there are many money shots. There's a compilation at the end of all of
Levi's. And Fuck Yeah Levi Carter is almost like following a little bit of a reality of his life as a porn performer.
Absolutely.
Talking to his mother, dealing with his boyfriend. So there's a really big arc in that movie.
Absolutely. And it also deals with another kind of confessional genre, which is Tumblr. I think the fuck yeah, this person's name, fuck yeah, this person's name is really something that comes out of Tumblr. And it really follows Levi Carter, who's active on social media, through his video diaries, which he had been recording according to Cocky Boys for 2 years before he started working with the studio. So you have these laptop recordings, you have phone recordings, you have digital camera recordings where you have direct-to-camera kind of confessionals, video diaries that play with the reality TV convention of the confessional, but also of the kind of more intimate video diary element. And there's self-filmed amateur video that goes along with it. So there's sex scenes that Carter has obviously filmed himself on his phone. There's one sequence where it's actually three images composited together into one, and they're upright vertical, so they've been filmed with the phone upright, which I think is a whole new interesting marker of amateurism. And so the idea of new authenticities is beyond seeing this performer's confessions of the body. We're looking for confessions of the person we're
emotional
looking for.
Confessions. Yeah.
Yeah, we want to have feelings, we want emotions. In the case of my dissertation, it's looking at either confessions of pleasure outside of desire or pleasure that can lead to new desires. And in the case of Fuck Yeah Levi Carter, it's really more attaching kind of a biographical to the pornographic.
And it makes sense because, I mean, look at Kim Kardashian. It wasn't enough that we had her sex tape. We only needed to have her life on reality television. So it's interesting that the sex tape used to be the indicator of reality. Now we need the reality to be the indicator of the reality, quote unquote, whatever that means. There's a new kind of aesthetics of reality.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of those is this kind of self-produced image from social media with Kim Kardashian.
The Kim Kardashian selfie book.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, the coffee table book of selfies. Also, Snapchat, I think, really changed the kind of aesthetic. Too, they have this front-facing camera aesthetic that is even more self-authored looking than previous examples like the webcam. And I think you see that in Fuck Yeah Levi Carter, and it kind of marries those two aesthetics together.
It's pretty interesting how the porn and the reality world are coming together. So what's the title of this paper and what triggered you to write it?
This paper is called He May Scorch the Screen with Men, But He Shares His Bed with a Woman, Discussing Sexual Identity in Pre-AIDS Gay Porn Magazines. And it actually stemmed from a meeting I had with Jerry Douglas. So you were there.
Yes, yes.
And it was at his apartment, and I was with Jeffrey Escoffier. It stems from the idea that Jeffrey put in his book and that other work that discusses that period in gay porn seem to agree with, that this new gay for pay star emerges out of the AIDS crisis. That the idea of heterosexuality as kind of a selling point for pornography is new and emerges as a reaction to the AIDS crisis, but also knowledge of transmission. So the knowledge that the bottom partner has a higher risk of transmission. And that was Jeffrey's hypothesis. That's what he...
And also that the heterosexual represents a disease-free...
Absolutely. Yeah, something that's totally outside of the scope of the AIDS crisis. And we were talking about that, and then Jerry was like, well, no, that's wrong. that's kind of insinuating also that we were really dumb for thinking that. He says that the idea of the eroticized heterosexual performer has not only existed for a long time, but there's also, it's been promoted. That's there in the 70s, that's there since the beginning. And so this is my hypothesis. I think this is something that he would agree with, but I think that's more, as opposed to like a drastic sea change, I think it's more of a kind of culmination of trends that you see operating through the 1970s, through the early 80s.
It is a trend, however, the context changes.
Absolutely.
I think both Jerry and Jeffrey can be right. They're both right, but the context has just totally radically changed.
Absolutely. Although the idea that heterosexuality as a selling point didn't exist before mid-80s is not correct. That was the fun detective work for me, digging through these mountains and mountains of magazines and looking for those instances.
Sure. So I guess you could start, just say the name of the paper again, and then you could just go right into it.
Sure. So the name of the paper is, "He May Scorch the Screen with Men, But He Shares His Bed with a Woman, Discussing Sexual Identity in Pre-AIDS Gay Porn Magazines." This paper examines the discourse surrounding the sexual identities of gay porn performers and models in commercially produced and nationally distributed gay porn magazines from their earliest iterations in the 1970s until the late 1980s and early 1990s. As my dissertation concerns itself with questions of reality, authenticity, and identity in online gay pornography featuring self-avowed heterosexual performers, this work aims to provide an introduction to and historical background for this contemporary iteration of gay for pay. In pornography's so-called golden age, which spans the late 1980s and early 1990s, a new breed of porn star emerges, the gay-for-pay performer. Gay-for-pay stars were identified as heterosexual and affected an aloof, dominant masculinity. Their performances were often limited to being the penetrative top partner in anal sex and the receptive partner in oral sex, standing in stark contrast to the freewheeling sexuality and libertarian exchange of the gay porn of the 1970s. Given the timing of the gay-for-pay star's ascent, it is often assumed that their heterosexuality became eroticized in response to the AIDS crisis. Porn stars who identified as gay were leaving the industry due to illness or even due to death, and the biggest stars of the 70s came to be seen as tainted by the virus, even before their own serostatus became public knowledge. Straight-identified performers who performed exclusively as tops, which carries a lower risk of transmission, could therefore be fantasized about as being untouched by the specter of AIDS. Though heterosexual performers had been working in gay porn since its inception, it has been said that their sexuality has always been incidental. Under the looming threat of the epidemic, it was argued that the new gay-for-pay star was successful not in spite of his off-screen sexual identity, but because of it. In this paper, I challenge the assumption that heterosexual identity only became a saleable feature for porn performers during or after the AIDS crisis. I suggest instead that sexual identity has not been incidental, but has been a mainstay of the public personas of gay porn performers and models, and that heterosexuality in particular, or any form of not-gayness, so bisexuality, undecidedness, sexual fluidity, has held erotic currency since some of the earliest iterations of gay porn. So I'll begin with a summary of the existing discourse on this gay-for-pay moment and its pornography and performers, which locates the first instances of gay pornography being sold on the basis of its performer's sexual identity as during the AIDS crisis. I then hope to complicate this theory first by singling out instances of eroticized heterosexuality in post-war indexes of gay desire and community, the Beefcake magazine and Underground Guides, and then via gay porn magazines from the 1970s onwards. Relying on archival research undertaken at both the One Gay and Lesbian Archive at the University of Southern California and the Canadian Lesbian and Gay Archives here in Toronto, I'll survey different treatments of models and performers' non-gay sexual identity as discussed in interviews, features, or reviews. Though this research is still ongoing, I believe that these initial findings suggest that gay-for-pay pornography and the gay-for-pay star were not a rapid sea change in the face of the AIDS crisis, but the result of the convergence of several pre-existing trends. And further, I hope to suggest that the naming of a porn star's non-gay sexual identity adds an additional air of authenticity. A note before I begin about the origins of this research. Though there are a few texts, scholarly or otherwise, that offer a comprehensive history of gay moving image pornography into the video years, the ones in existence point to the golden age moment of the late 80s as a turning point, and to the gay-for-pay star as the first instance of the eroticization of the heterosexual performer. I'd follow Jeffrey Escoffier, who, in his wonderful book Bigger Than Life, The History of Gay Porn from Beefcake to Hardcore, singles out Jeff Stryker as the first instance of gay pornography using a performer's sexual identity as a marketing tool. It was in a meeting with Jeffrey and legendary gay porn director and editor of Manshots magazine, Jerry Douglas, that Jerry told both of us that we were wrong, that sexual identity had been utilized as a marketing tool long before Jeff Stryker, gay porn's golden age, or AIDS. So this research is greatly indebted to him. Gay for pay performers are often treated with a certain degree of disdain. Given the centrality of pornography to gay identity, both historically and at present, this shouldn't come as much of a surprise. But their performances and personas are often unfavorably compared to those in the film pornography of the 1970s, which is remembered and retold from the other end of the AIDS crisis with liberationist and utopian undertones. John Berger, in One-Handed Histories, remembers that, quote, in those halcyon exploratory days of the celebration of the more open and free gay lifestyle, all levels of erotic experience were faithfully documented by the porn industry. In the pornography of this era, he writes, any and every sexual act was acceptable. While group scenarios like orgies and glory holes, quote, diffuse the possibilities of emotional connection and dependence, a pre-AIDS fluid exchange could be highly charged in an interpersonally emotional sense. Though he acknowledges gay pornography's identitarian bent, Escoffier admits that performers who are predominantly heterosexual have played a significant role in the gay porn industry since it started, writing that producers and viewers responded to a performer's ability to have sex with another man in front of the camera. No one cared whether or not the performer identified as homosexual or gay. His performance was all that mattered. So I'm not suggesting that the AIDS crisis did not have a drastic impact on the mechanics, performances, and the tone of gay pornography. There's a palpable difference in the videos of the late 70s, early 80s, and those of the late 80s, early 90s, that I believe is driven in part by larger trends that predate the AIDS crisis. But in the interest of time, what I'd like to focus on is that straightness or not gayness is a new development, or that no one cared about a porn performer's sexual identity. It's clear that audiences did care, and they had been caring for a long time. So not only does the idea that a heterosexual model or performer would be appealing to a gay audience predate the video porn of the late 80s, it actually predates commercial moving image pornography entirely. In the Beefcake magazines of the 1950s and 1960s, Thomas Waugh suggests that a valorization of non-gayness, of straightness, is poignantly implied in the format's reliance on homosocial spaces such as military, athletic, and educational institutions. The images in Beefcake magazines are, quote, structured by the point of view of both insider and outsider, he writes, the wish-fulfillment fantasy of belonging and the invisible voyeurism of the one who can never belong. Further, he identifies a recurring motif in Beefcake imagery, models reading or looking at dirty pictures. Prior to the mid-1960s, these images are all of naked women, which he suggests the invocation of straightness as a turn-on for the gay consumer. Though the model's sexuality might be suggested directly via the use of erotic photographs of women, or indirectly with recourse to homosocial settings, it's never explicitly stated in the magazines. But beginning in 1965, readers of Beefcake magazine Physique Pictorial could, for the cost of a self-addressed stamped envelope, send away for a key to the cryptic symbols that publisher Bob Meiser would use to annotate his photographs. So here I have an image of a kind of guide to all these cryptic symbols that Meiser would use, and he would draw on the photographs, kind of like the male symbol, so circles with arrows, lots of squiggles, some stars. There's a version of this on the Bob Meiser Foundation website, but it leaves out kind of the juicy ones. So, Meiser's hieroglyphs identified character traits such as early riser, or tends to form lasting friendships, to assessments of their genitalia, big or small meat, to lists of sexual acts they would or would not perform, can be sucked, will fuck, to sexual identities, married, likes girls, or not sure what he wants. In the presentation, I have two pages from issue of Physique Pictorial from January 1986. One of them is annotated with symbols that mean liking girls, can be sucked, can be fucked, and is an expensive hustler. In the second photograph, which is of two men identified as Joe and Bob Kaiser, Joe is identified as liking girls, willing to be sucked, willing to be fucked, and as a male whore who is dumb. His brother Bob likes girls and can be sucked, and is a hustler. So there's both male whore and hustler are available hieroglyphs. I'm not exactly sure what Meiser's differentiation is. Beefcake models for Waugh epitomize the post-war gay icons of the hustler and of trade, a term for straight-identified men who engage in homosexual sex. In the first edition of The Gay Girl's Guide, a piece of underground gay literature printed and distributed by Soixante Neuf, which is a pseudonym derived from an anglicization of Soixante Neuf, French for 69. Its Gay-E's English Dictionary defines trade as, quote, a general term for one who wants to be blown without reciprocating and with no commercial implication per se. Divides into subordinate classes such as gay trade, rough trade, commercial trade, and possibly also dirt, unquote. They also define butch as meaning not a homosexual and straight as synonym for butch. And they provide useful guides for distinguishing between these various types of trade. In this guide, we can observe the desire to classify and categorize non-gay men who are nonetheless game, under specific circumstances, for sexual activity with other men, but we can also observe a valorization of the real thing. The guide warns readers to, quote, beware of well-built, well-dressed, good-looking youths who, while they don't sound gay, are ready to take initiative at every turn, and may drop hints and phrases, without humor, to suggest that they've been around. So by the time we reach the mid-1970s, when gay porn magazines had become to circulate commercially, model and performer identity is still considered of interest to their readership. The magazine I consulted include In Touch magazine from 1973 to 1987, In Heat magazine from 77 to 83, Skin Flicks magazine to 80 to 83, Skin magazine from 80 to 85, Blue Boy magazine from 76 to 94, and Mandate from 75 to 88, in addition to several undated 1970s direct mail porn catalogs for companies such as Falcon, Old Reliable, and Brentwood. So while this represents hundreds of issues, it's still only a fraction of the magazines produced in these years. And though the research is ongoing, I believe at this point that my work offers both a significant sample size and appropriate date range from which to begin drawing up some preliminary observations. So in all of these issues, I looked for indication of not gay identity in interviews with or discussions of porn performers or models, so either by the staff of the magazines or in letters to the editor, in advertisements for porn loops, scenes, and videos, or reviews and previews of pornographic releases. I then sort them according to date and according to identity formation. So there's straight, which is either identified by explicit use of the term or by an exclusive interest in women. Bisexual, explicitly named, liking guys and girls, where a desire for both genders is identified, sometimes with a preference, but without claiming any bisexual label. And then undefined non-gay, a kind of catch-all in which sexual identity is either left deliberately ambiguous or all labels are refused. So this often looks like, I don't like categories, or my sexuality is universal. So here I have a slide where I have the number of references to a performer's straight identity through the years. So from 1974 we have 2, 1975 we have 3, 76 we have 5, 77 2, in 81 and 82 there are 5 references that I come across, and then in 83 and 85 just 1. But when you include all of the aforementioned not gay identities, we see a higher number, but still a similar distribution. So the highest number is in 1981 of 11, and then in 1983 to 1991, the number remains at 1 per year. So we see this highest concentration in 1976 and 1981 at the very cusp of the AIDS crisis, but then a downturn in the years following. And the discussion of non-gay identity is treated in varying ways. So it can be presented as something titillating but somehow off-limits or just out of reach, as in an interview with straight porn star John Milius, who appeared in the straight porn classic The Resurrection of Eve in the September 74 issue of In Touch. The author discusses his high school experience after noting that he was on the swim team and dated cheerleaders, and the author asks him, I suppose you had some locker room experiences? The article continues, cross your mind flash images of robust, happy youths splashing about in the showers. He enjoys your excitement and doesn't want to disappoint you. He leans back. His legs are spread as he sits there in the chair and you have a fine view. Is the movement instinctive or calculated? You can't imagine. But he smiles. J.O. sessions? Oh, sure. In a profile of gay porn performer George Payne from In Heat in January 1977, which is where I get the title of my talk, the author writes, after seeing Payne sexually cavorting on screen with his male co-stars, it is hard to imagine him sharing a bed with a woman, but it's true. In an age where writers, artists, and actors are publicly admitting their gayness, Payne is busy throwing a tarpaulin over his. First of all, I'm an actor, Payne says. And that's how I feel I come across no matter if I do porno or legitimate films. But how can Payne claim he, quote, loves women in his private life and bed down with men on screen? Like I said, I'm an actor, Payne says. But a few seconds later he whispers, I'm in it for the money. Or take a profile of Tim, who is discovered dancing in a New Jersey woman's burlesque bar from Blue Boy magazine in December 1981. Tim says that he dances in both men's and women's clubs, and while gay men are, quote, more critical, he has no reservations about doing it. Just because I'm straight doesn't mean that men can't look at me. No, I'm actually flattered. The author asks Tim if he's ever thought about being gay, and he answers, no, men just aren't attractive to me from the sexual point of view. But I can see why guys get together. Having someone as strong as me to come home to, that would be nice. In other instances, not gay sexual fluidity is depicted as mysterious or tantalizing or simply as modern. Colt Studios model Chuck Shields is profiled in the July 1975 issue of Mandate, and I quote, "Rugged Chuck Shields, all 6'2", 215 pounds of him, has a larger-than-life, wide-stride stance of uncompromising self-assurance. According to photographer Rip Colt, Chuck's a, quote, regular good time Charlie. He swings with either gender and never heard of guilt. This is the man of the 80s. A 1975 interview with gay porn star Jim Cassidy, again from In Touch magazine, describes him as sexually democratic. In real life, as on the screen, Jim expresses no preference for male sexual partners over female, or vice versa. His preferences are for individual people, that certain someone can easily be of either sex. On screen, he does what he's told, whether the partner is interesting or not, and it is a tribute to his native acting ability that he always manages to look like he's enjoying it. In his own bedroom, however, sex is not a job, but a joy, and he expresses no qualms about seeking that joy with whom he finds mutual attraction. In a feature called Unforgettable Porno Faces from Skinflix magazine in 1981, George Payne is described as, quote, the porno star's porno star, unrecognizable from photo to photo, movie to movie, but always himself, does both straight and gay films, never giving any hint of which he's most comfortable in. Straightness can also be treated with a knowing wink, an understanding between the author and the readership that even those who self-identify as straight may in fact be trade or may be enticed to experiment. So there's a photo spread of Ken Hoffman in In Touch magazine in 1982 that's titled He's a Handful, correction, he's three handsful. And in it, the author describes how he met the model. Quote, "We met Ken Hoffman at Griffith Park. He is, of course, straight. Super straight, he tells us. Ah yes, our favorite kind of stranger to meet while walking on such a deserted, such a notorious dirt path on the orgy side of Griffith Park. Where do they come from, all these super straight boys with their dicks of Godzilla and their buns of Bambi? How do they stumble, so regularly, onto the paths of least resistance? Oh yes," he adds, "and he loves to fuck. Girls, wouldn't you know? Girls only. Thing is, girls are so hard to meet in California." And then finally, I have an ad from porn studio Old Reliable. That's from 1974, that teases both the flexibility of straight identity and the thrill of transgression. So a scene called Doug and Joe is described as arrogant Doug has the tables turned on him by his straight college friend, Joe the Jock. I should note about Old Reliable that their scenes are really similar to the kind of amateur military scenes where there's not a storyline, it's two people sitting on a couch and it starts from there. So while these are but a few examples, they're a telling sample of gay magazines' treatment of straight and not gay but fluid sexual identity prior to the AIDS crisis. So while Gay for Pay becomes named in the 1980s, eroticized heterosexual identity in gay pornography predates this by more than a decade and can be seen in the proto-gay porn Beefcake magazines of the 1950s and 60s. These interviews, profiles, and advertisements point not only to the enduring appeal of straightness to many gay men, which has been well documented elsewhere, but to a desire to know the real sexual identity of the performers in gay pornography, a sexual identity that might exceed or not align with their sexual preference on film or on video. It speaks to a truth beyond the traditional evidentiary claims in moving image pornography, erections, close-up of penetrations, the money shot. But beyond this, it signals a desire to unmoor sexual activity from sexual identity, or even from desire, and suggests the possibility of an extra-erotic charge in doing this work.
So interesting. That it almost seemed like there was an opposite correlation from the hit of the AIDS crisis to the identifying of straight gay porn performers.
Yeah, that was kind of one of the most surprising results of this. At that same time, like, one of the things I didn't have time to talk about in this paper is the construction of the porn persona of Jeff Stryker. And it's often talked about how he's constructed as being straight, but in most of his interviews, he's constructed as being catch-all, not gay. Like, he's actually refusing any labels, refusing to claim gay or straight identity. He talks about romantic partners. So both of his discoverers, Matt Sterling and John Travis, he had romantic relationships with both of them. He talks about that at length. He talks about sexual partners he's had who have been both male and female. So there seems to be a resistance to the fact that he's not claiming gay identity that leads people to believe that he's claiming a straight one. But there's really a focus on this kind of not gay identity in that moment as well.
My favorite part actually is when there's this almost inherent reading of the consumer of the magazine. It almost seems like it's this very weak and scared person who's looking for a very strong, very protective daddy to come and save him. You could read as much as they think of what their readers, who they imagine them being, through this work.
Absolutely. And the fact that you see that operating in like 1974 in the mid-70s is something that is interesting to think of on this side of the AIDS crisis as well. And that you see this kind of valorization of the healthy gay male body, which is also thought of as something that's a reaction to the AIDS crisis, way before that as well.
I can't wait till the book comes out so we can have you on for a whole episode. Thank you so much, Daniel.
And, thank you very much for having me.
Good luck for the rest of your conference.
Thank you.
I want to thank Elizabeth and Daniel again for being so generous with their scholarship. They're really doing the Lord's work of going through the archives page by page, and they deserve major credit for unearthing all of this important sexual history. Thanks so much for making it a part of the show. I really do appreciate it. You can find out more about Elizabeth's book in the show notes. In the show notes, you'll also find a link to Daniel's short documentary that he completed for his MFA thesis. It documents the phenomena of gay-for-pay performers. He not only interviews a lot of important academics, but he also talks with actual gay-for-pay performers. It's a wonderful little documentary, so please be sure to check it out. While you're looking through the show notes, be sure to check us out on social media. You can follow us on facebook.com/academicsex and on Twitter @pornocultures. Thanks so much for listening, and I look forward to getting sexy with you next time. Bye.